supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
Welcome to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott, sitting in for Dan Gottlieb today. This is the second part of our series on the economy, and we'll discuss how we can get through this difficult time and how we might change as a result. Later on, we'll be joined by Dacher Keltner, author of Born to be Good, and Peter Weibrow, author of American Mania. But first, let's take a look at how therapists and mental health centers are tackling new challenges posed by the tough economy. Mental health providers across our region report an increased demand. At the same time, budgets for mental health services are being cut and people have less money for therapy. I spoke to some therapists and providers in our region. Let's hear the report. No matter what the economy is like, money is an important topic in therapy sessions. It's a common source of anxiety and strife in relationships. Right now, though, many therapists find themselves dealing with their own stress. Their desire for financial stability can conflict with their stated mission to help people.
This is what I do. This is what I'm trained for. It's not to turn people away, and yet it's to decide what my limits are.
Therapist Paul Feiler has seen several clients cut down or stop sessions in recent months because of financial worries. He works both in New York and Philadelphia, and his clients include stockbrokers and Wall Street executives. Feiler doesn't take insurance payments. His patients pay out of pocket. He says that when therapy comes to a sudden halt, it's difficult for both parties involved.
So much of the work isn't just about being compensated. It's about this unique relationship that develops over time. So I think when it ends somewhat abruptly, when somebody realizes, wow, I've lost my job, that's hard.
Like many of his colleagues, Feiler's trying to come up with ways to provide services and hang on to his client base. Sliding scales are one way. Another is a sort of happy hour discount for therapy.
The peak hours are in the evenings, usually in the early morning, before and after work. So if somebody's willing to come during the day, that may be a way of lowering the fee. Another one is to consider group, because group is usually less expensive.
Philadelphia therapist Deborah Whalen has only lost one client so far whose home was foreclosed. But she says financial worries are a big issue in sessions these days.
I think that across the board, people are just really concerned about how long this is going to go on. There's all of these question marks, which just increases anxiety.
Whalen says this is her first experience at doing therapy during a recession. She's been talking with colleagues about how best to adjust to new challenges. Nationally, counseling centers and community mental health facilities say many more people are seeking their help, even as strapped governments cut budgets. In Pennsylvania, Joan Ernie, Deputy Secretary in the Office of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, encouraged agencies to try to reduce costs without cutting services.
I think that we are in unique economic times and that we all have to contribute to assure that folks will be okay. And quite honestly, we really want and believe that there are still administrative efficiencies that can be accomplished at the agency level as well as at the county level, and that's really what we're going to seek to have them cut.
Dr. Colleen Logan, president of the American Counseling Association, says this is the kind of moment counselors are trained for.
The research says, and our training tells us, that we are the long pole in the tent in terms of being the ones that can help everyday people with everyday problems, and in this case, everyday people with extraordinary problems.
At Friends Hospital in Philadelphia, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Mark Rothman worries that people with money woes might be reluctant to seek help.
For example, if someone doesn't have insurance, they might be afraid of incurring additional costs, so they might be staying away from the crisis center or making the call that they need.
As his profession adjusts in a troubled economy, therapist Paul Feiler has shifted his focus a bit. He's providing coaching for people who lost their jobs and are trying to figure out what's next.
Some of the work is to really support them in identifying their strengths and where at this point in their careers they would like to go.
That was a look at how therapists and counselors are dealing with the challenges posed by a tough economy. One topic that is sure to come up in sessions these days is money and relationships. Many couples have to rework their budgets, rethink what money means to them, and if they've been affected by job loss, roles in the household could be changing. Joining us now is family therapist Richard Brauzel. He practices in Wilmington, Delaware. Richard, thank you so much for being on Voices in the Family.
I'm happy to be with you.
Now, let's talk first about the role that money plays in relationships. What does it really mean, and how do couples talk about it or not?
Well, the role of money in relationships is as varied as the types of relationships themselves. Fundamentally, money really is all about basic survival. Beyond that, it is one of the ways that we can really tell what's really happening in a relationship in terms of balance, fairness, allocation of discrete resources, and what it symbolizes in terms of honesty and even intimacy. So it really does take on a number of different meanings.
Talk about the unspoken contract that many couples have when it comes to finances.
The unspoken contract very often is all about what the unspoken roles are. For example, you know, in traditional relationships, the unspoken contract is, well, I, the man, will go out and earn the money, and you, the wife, will write the checks and take care of the bills and take care of the home. That's very often the basic assumption at the beginning. Those contracts very often fail to be as effective as they need to be, and very often when couples are encountering conflicts over money, what they're really encountering is a need to rework the contract, to go back to the drawing board and to reestablish what feels most fair and most reasonable all the way around for not just the couple but the entire family system.
And how do you begin to do that without getting into, well, you spend $65 on a haircut, no, you bought a shirt that was way too expensive. You know, how do you have that conversation without getting into little fights?
It's very difficult. That's why money is very often the most difficult of all issues for a couple to encounter. When I'm working with a couple, I try to get them, and it's difficult, but try to get them to take the focus off of the details because it's very easy to get lost in the details. I try to get them to pull back a bit and take a look at what the underlying issues are truly all about. Is it about honesty? For example, a lot of people will go ahead and spend money and incur debt without informing their partners, and sometimes those expenditures are significant. Nevertheless, how money is spent really affects the couple. It affects both people, and so it can be tantamount to what we might think of as financial infidelity. So we want to take a step back and not get caught up in the details, but look at is money really about honesty? Is the way money is being spent really about how two people are failing to communicate about what the basic needs are in the relationship? And it very often is about two people not really having a mission statement between the two of them. They can't unite around how money is being allocated because they don't have a common sense of what their relationship is all about and where they want it to head in terms of what their relationship ultimately is supposed to mean, where they're going in terms of not just goals relative to savings, but goals relative to good communication, harmony, coordination of daily lives. So when I see people, you know, doing a lot of finger pointing, it indicates to me that there's a lot of chaos in how they're communicating, and we really want to go right to the issues of good, decent communication, ethical behavior, and both people needing to shift their focus on what do they want their relationship to mean in the sum totality of it all.
And that would be, that's the mission statement, is
that's the mission
statement. What do we want, where do we want to go?
Exactly. And once people are able to establish a common sense of what they want their relationship to mean, then it gets to be a lot easier to develop a whole different set of plans about how problems get solved, how money gets spent, what kinds of other resources need to be tapped into so that we're not fulfilling our emotional needs through unrealistic spending, but meeting our emotional needs through better connectedness, maybe finding creative ways to do things rather than just going out and spending a lot of money to solve a problem. There may be a lot of other ways that two people can solve problems. If they're together, they can put their heads together and their hearts together around a common problem.
Now let's talk, what happens if one partner loses their job and is suddenly home much more? Roles may change, where one person was the major provider before, now is not. Sometimes people aren't used to spending that much time together either.
Well, it's huge, and it really depends on why the job gets lost. If a job is lost through no fault of one's own because a company is downsizing, it's still a major hit, and it's a major source of grief and anxiety. I think that couples go through some initial shock and chaos because the system now, which was already stressed to the max, has gone through a complete upheaval. It's a bit like, I guess the analogy is if you're flying an airplane and suddenly you have no visual cues and you can't tell whether your airplane's upside down or right side up, and you're in the clouds. You go then, if you're a pilot, you look at your instruments and that tells you where you are and what you're doing. Once you go through that initial chaos in a marriage where somebody loses a job, it is a period of tremendous reorganization and some grief and a loss of identity. But once you get through that, you have to then help the couple. I try to help the couple go to what they know, to go to their resources, to go to previous experiences when they've had a crisis, and they've been able to tap into their strengths and resources and get reoriented. The role shift is a difficult one. If you have a man who's always been the breadwinner and he's never swept the floor or washed a dish, it does require an expanding of one's self-definition. And the other spouse, you know, can certainly be supportive of that, because it may be that now the woman is going out to work and the man is staying home. So they really have to be able to broaden their scope and broaden their vision of what's possible. Where there's a job loss because of fault, either an employee has been let go of because of some malfeasance or drug abuse or drug addiction or something, it's really much more difficult, and that's a whole separate category of strain. And those are the couples that I truly worry about. Some of those people go through such a loss of identity, especially in a very difficult job market, that it takes a lot of extra care on the part of the therapist to ensure that those people are going to be okay. We have to listen for suicidal feelings, feelings of acute depression, and that's a very special category of case.
So, Richard Brazel, as people are going through these difficult times, really briefly, what are some positives that can come out of these tough times?
Well, it's a good question, and I think that a lot of positives can come out of it. It's a bit like what happens in a snowstorm where we're having, you know, we're suddenly jammed into the house with one another, and we might find there a greater sense of camaraderie, a greater sense of collective problem solving and strengths. We may find that we're able to feel stronger and more connected because we're going through something together, and we're able to help each other in ways that we never thought we would have to. Very often, it allows us to tap into family resources. You know, when we're going through a crisis, we might turn an ear to our uncles, our aunts, our grandparents, how did they get through it in the Depression? How did they get through it when times were hard? So we may discover new strengths in our relationships between spouses and between ourselves and other people. We may find that we're learning. We look back into history, into the time of the Depression. How did people get through it then? And it expands our knowledge and our sense of resiliency. And I think resiliency is the key word. We may discover that that we don't have to be so afraid, that we really can spring back from this crisis and find strengths within ourselves and within our relationships.
And Richard, that is the theme that we want to continue on, and we have to move on, but I want to thank you so much for your time and for your advice.
My pleasure.
Richard Brazel is a therapist in Wilmington, Delaware. We're going to take a short break, and coming up, we'll hear from Dr. Peter Weibrow and Dr. Dacher Keltner, and we'll talk, you know, about what we can do to get through this and where we can go from here. I'm Maiken Scott, sitting in for Dan Gottlieb today. You're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY FM.
Pennsylvania Ballet supports WHYY and presents the classic fairy tale Cinderella at the Academy of Music March 13th through the 21st. Happily Ever After comes to the stage with Prokofiev's score, a bachelor prince, a prima ballerina, scheming stepsisters, and the glass slipper. Pennsylvania Ballet's production of Cinderella. For tickets to Cinderella, 215-893-1999 or online at paballet.org.
Singer-songwriter Nico Case understands that listening to music is an intensely personal experience.
You want the song to give you that nostalgic feeling because it's like this unbiased voice of compassion in the dark.
I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. And this week on Sound Opinions, we shed light on that voice in the dark, Nico Case, with her new album, Middle Cyclone.
Let me know you think about me too.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
And welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Maiken Scott, sitting in for Dan Gottlieb today. This is the second part in our series on the economy, and we're talking about what we can do about the stress and the anxiety and where to go from here. My next guests both believe that this could actually be an opportunity to rethink what's important to us and how we live our lives. Joining us now are Dr. Dacher Keltner and Dr. Peter Weibrow. Peter Weibrow is the director of the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior and the author of American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. And Dacher Keltner is professor of psychology at Berkeley, and his research focuses on emotion. He has written a book called Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. Thank you both for being here today.
Absolutely. It's great to be here. What a great topic.
And Peter, let's start with you. You've said that we've all contributed to our current economic problems as much as we'd like to blame the banks and Wall Street, but talk a little bit about the way we live on credit and our relationship with debt.
Well, we have done that, as you infer, for two or three decades. It's always been the American way, and it has accelerated in the last two or three decades, largely because we deregulated lots of things, including the banks, of course, but credit card debt, bank debt, debt in general has become the way in which we've lived. What that means, of course, is we mortgaged our futures, and then when everything goes bad, suddenly we realize that we're unable to pay the debt for the future, and suddenly then we find ourselves facing a crisis that we didn't even think about 10 years ago, because we believed that everything would continue to expand and we could live on debt. So it's something which has happened at all levels of society, and now suddenly, as opposed to paying the credit cards, we're beginning to save again, which I think is a good sign.
But what happened? You would think that having major debt would give you anxiety. How did we manage to dull that feeling out for so long? Did we replace it with another feeling?
Well, if you think about it, nobody was worrying about debt. It was considered to be the American way of securing the material dream. And so it was a sort of a cultural delusion, I guess, that we would never have to worry because housing prices would continue to go up, jobs would continue to pay more money, full employment would be there. We didn't have to worry about the future because it would take care of itself, in which case debt was not considered to be what it really is, which is, as I said earlier, mortgaging oneself into the future.
So is that what we do when we live in abundance, when everything seems mm-hmm. to be fine, we just kind of get a little dull?
Exactly. I mean, the human brain is set up such that we are quite capable of being very thoughtful and planning ahead and figuring out ways, ingenious ways, in fact, of dealing with very little. But when you have a two or three generations of individuals who've been taught that actually everything they want will be immediately available to them, you can buy a house without any money down and live in it, and in fact even mortgage the house again and live on the contents of the house, that has a very interesting deep psychological meaning to people. They somehow forget that hard times need thoughtful planning because they've never met them.
So this is something we will have to...
Abundance is something that human beings have very little experience with, and we just don't know how to handle it. We grew up in scarcity, and most of our brain function and even our physiology is geared to scarcity.
Now, Decker, let me turn to you. Your book is called Born to be Good, and that certainly does not come to mind when we look at what happened on Wall Street and what happened all around us. You know, born to be cutthroat, born to watch the bottom line comes to mind. So how can you say we're born to be good in the face of all that?
Well, you know, I mean, first of all, I think a lot of people have attributed the problems in Wall Street to basic greed and a loss of the values by which we take care of others. And the reason that I take heart in the idea that we're born to be good is exactly in times of scarcity, you very often see, as Peter was suggesting, some of these evolved tendencies to care for others, to give, to build strong connection, which are really one of the best answers in times of scarcity.
So is there something that happens to us that makes us less good as we grow up? Things that we learn that reinforce different behaviors?
Well, I think Peter really hit it on the head, which is that, you know, we have to take a look at what our culture is doing and the extent to which it is cultivating and nurturing these more pro-social caretaking tendencies. And what we know about American culture, and in Peter's terms, American mania, is the past 20 to 25 years have been a time of rampant materialism and where the belief that never-ending financial gain is the source of happiness. And what we've also learned is that that cultural value is a profound mistake. For most people, materialism and their financial gain doesn't bring happiness. What really matters is their social connections.
And Peter, are we going through withdrawal then right now if we've been in the cycle of materialism?
Well, you could say that. Yes, I guess. No, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think the two of us see it the same way. The fact is that we are going through withdrawal, and one of the problems is that we haven't had the experience of connecting together and solving the problems because we built a very individualistically driven society, a celebrity-based society in which it wasn't so long ago, for example, that Mr. Bush was claiming that we should have an ownership society. You remember that when Social Security would be in the stock market and all the other things. We'd each take care of ourselves. Well, if you're earning an enormous amount of money, that's possible to do. You can live in your own enclave and forget everybody else. But that isn't the way the world works. And I absolutely agree. It's when we come together that we become creative. So in our withdrawal, I think we are actually going to find some very interesting dimensions of the basic human experience and also of the American mythology, which was not what it has been in the last two or three years. It was a much more visionary thing about what we were trying to do to build a society which was different from other societies, egalitarian, caring, etc., etc.
And I want to encourage our listeners to call in at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499. Talk about what kind of coping strategies you've developed to deal with tough economic times, what you're hoping for the future, what's getting you through. But let me ask both of you then, maybe we'll start with you, Dacher. Some people will say prosperity makes people happy, and what's wrong with everybody having things and having nice houses and having nice cars? Where did we go wrong, in your opinion?
Well, it really is a matter of degree. I mean, we know from the science of happiness, and this is based on hundreds of studies, that as long as you have the basic material conditions of survival satisfied, you have the opportunity to be happy. And I think, you know, a lot of people in the United States have those conditions. And where we've gone wrong is in the past 20 years, we have and survey data find that this is the case, that we think that acquiring material goods over important social experiences will bring happiness. We think that working that extra 10 hours a week to build up the portfolio will bring happiness, and we know that that those are wrong, and what we're losing in the process is time with the kids, time with the family, as Richard said earlier in the show, and time in community, and those are the things that we need to recreate.
So that's, Peter, also you would agree, those are the things...
Oh, I absolutely agree with Daka. Yes, I think that's exactly where we are. And, I mean, it's not all bad, actually.
Absolutely.
It had to come, and now I think we can reorient ourselves a little and think about the future in a way that is constructive as opposed to destructive, which is what we've been doing.
And Peter, that brings up another question then, because I think our economy in large part is built on our desire, never-ending desire for more stuff. So now, if first of all, we can't afford the stuff anymore, and second of all, we're saying the stuff isn't good for us, then what do we do? And how can businesses then reorient themselves? I know you're not an economist, but I just wanted you to kind of venture.
It's a central question, and I think that even those of us who are not carrying economic degrees, those of us who know something about behavior, realize that the economic model, the Chicago model particularly, has been, again, part of that self-destructive course, because we've come up with a model where unless the GNP is growing at 3% a year, we feel as if we've not achieved anything. You know, but it depends on how you measure the growth. We could have a growth of all sorts of interesting things, like the growth of our ability to send young people, regardless of income, to school and to university, which would engage our intellectual capital for the future. We could talk about how we could provide health care, which is an enormous drag on this country. The social mobility in Europe is now greater than it is in the U.S., largely because they have those two things. So there are all sorts of things we can do that would create a society which would be exciting and engaged, but it wouldn't be engaged with the larger refrigerator and a 64-inch TV. Not that there's anything wrong with them, but if that's the only thing that one has, it becomes very self-destructive, as I said earlier.
Dacher, do you want to venture a guess on which kind of businesses will do better with these challenges?
Well, I think Peter's speculations are very interesting, and I think this is a time when we're going to have to reconceptualize what goods are that are in the marketplace, and I think it's a great opportunity for goods that are about education and about art and about healthcare practices, things that are these kind of commodities that will be spread on the internet and the like. And I think we're going to see hopefully a new economy that's based on a different kind of social goods.
I agree.
But first, I'm sure there are a lot of challenges. Let's say I'm a parent of a teenager, and the teenager thinks the path to happiness is the new iPhone, and I say the path to happiness is you talking to me and being connected and us laughing together, they won't understand probably. So how do we make that transition first as a family and then as a community? Peter, maybe we'll start with
you. You're hitting on the most important questions, which all of us must face. And I don't think we can retreat back to what we've been doing, because obviously that didn't work, as Daka said. And just not to push it unnecessarily, but some years ago, after American Mania was published, I was contacted by a group called Simple Living America. Hmm. And they are an interesting group of people. They now have... They have a radio show, a television show. They also have chapters, essentially, all over the country where you can meet with other people who are facing exactly that dilemma that you describe. You know, do I buy myself or my child a new iPhone when the one I have, it works perfectly well? And the notion is that there are many ways to get satisfied beyond the material, and it helps. You know, you were talking about earlier about group therapy. Well, it doesn't have to be formal group therapy. Just sitting about in somebody's sitting room and deciding what is the best place to buy a sweater for the winter, coming winter. that's a way in which people can bond together and they can find ways of coping with difficult circumstances, a little bit like the victory gardens of the Second World War or the times during the Depression when people met together to grow vegetables. And I mean, it sounds rather hokey, but in fact, social behaviors are what made the human animal dominant in the world, and we just need to get back to them.
And Dacre, what are some of the strategies that people could develop to deal with their situation right now in this moment? If they face tough challenges paying the mortgage, if they've lost their job, how do you deal with that anxiety?
Well, you know, I think that there are two kinds of wisdom that we derive from this new science of happiness and the good life. And one, you know, we are this, as Richard said earlier, this amazingly resilient species. And Peter has commented upon that. And so one approach is really to do certain things that reduce that chronic level of stress. And we know, for example, that we should really make an attempt to not ruminate about it, not dwell on the financial crisis around the clock. We should turn to physical strategies for coping with stress, things like exercise and even meditation and yoga. There are a lot of new findings out saying that that calms the nervous system. And then the other side to resilience and the immediate practical strategies that people can employ is to really to rely on the things that build up strong social connections. And I'll just give you a couple. We know, for example, that generosity, there are new studies coming out that if you give in times like these, you actually derive greater joy than if you gratify an impulse or spend on some hidden desire. So that should be an orientation. We know, for example, that in times like these, there's a greater press to provide care, you know, for older parents or people who've lost their job or their retirement package. And I just want to reassure your listeners, there are new studies coming out, for example, by Stephanie Brown out at Michigan, that care providers live longer than those who don't. So these are opportunities to, as Peter said, to bring these great American virtues back into focus. And I think the benefits will be enormous.
Let's bring in some of our listeners at 1-888-477-9499. We have Kara on the phone. Hi, Kara. You're on Voices.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make a comment about another way to redeem these lost social connections through an organization that already exists called the Time Bank. And it's an organization where you exchange services, and the currency is time. For instance, if you help someone move, and you spend 2 hours helping someone move, then if I were to do that, then I might actually be able to ask someone else in the Time Bank community, in the membership, to spend 2 hours splitting wood for me. And it's something that really pulls people together in ways that you wouldn't even expect. Like, it helps people understand how they were maybe reluctant to ask for things before, and how much we actually need each other, and how satisfying it is, and how we can actually even make time in our busy schedules to do things for other people because we're going to be getting something in return as well.
That's a great point, Kara. Thank you so much for calling in. And Peter, have you seen things like that spring up?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think this is the intuitive sense of the human resilience, which you're beginning to see in operation. That's basically a barter system. We know very much that time is actually a commodity that is even scarce, more scarce than money. And so I think that that's exactly the way in small communities that people will get through this. And it adds another dimension, which we haven't talked about, but I would be curious as to what Dacre feels about this, which is that it adds an element of control for the individual. And what drives anxiety is people feeling they have no future way out of the current dilemma. And so when you're working with somebody else and they're helping you and you're helping them on childcare and so on and so forth, one then begins to relax and feel, I can make it through, and that reduces the anxiety. And then what happens is the individual makes much more sensible decisions. And so I think it becomes a self-reinforcing positive loop which enables people to find good things in dark times.
Dacre, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, you know, Peter is spot on, and I love Kara's observation that there are going to be these new networks and new currencies that bring people together in times like this. And what we know from the stress literature is that the two critical things to solve your stress problems are social connection, which is what we've been talking about, and those new networks and new currencies will bring people together, and, as Peter is saying, a sense of control that diminishes this profound uncertainty that people are feeling right now. And these new economies and new networks are going to be one of the great solutions to that.
Okay, we want to take a short break here. We're talking, you just heard the voice of Dacher Keltner. He is professor of psychology at Berkeley and the author of Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. We're also joined by Peter Weibrow. He's the author of American Mania, When More is Not Enough. We're going to take a short break. I'm Mike and Scott, sitting in for Dan Gottlieb today, and you're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY-FM.
Thomas Jefferson University's School of Population Health supports WHYY and offers master's degrees in public health, health policy, and healthcare quality and safety. An open house will be held Wednesday, March 11th at 6 p.m. in the Dorrance H. Hamilton Building, 1001 Locust Street. Registration by phone 215-503-5305 or online at jefferson.edu. The Jefferson School of Population Health, helping to make a difference in healthcare.
On the next Fresh Air, stand-up comic Maz Jobrani, formerly of the Axis of Evil comedy tour. His family's from Iran, and his mother wanted him to be a lawyer or a washing machine fixer guy. Something steady, you know, in case of a revolution. But Maz didn't listen. He became an actor and is now a comedian on a stand-up tour. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
And welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott, sitting in for Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about the economy, where we can go from here, what we can do to go on. And we're joined by Dacher Keltner and Peter Weibrow. Keltner is the author of Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, and Weibrow is the author of American Mania, When More is Not Enough. And before our break, we were talking a little bit about what it will take to move on, how to form new models that will work in this economy. And I want to ask both of you, do you think we have it in us? You know, when we look at the generation of our parents and grandparents who got through World War II, through all these challenges, and they got through, and then you look around in the local supermarket and people have a meltdown when their favorite brand of dog food isn't in the aisle, and it makes you wonder, do we have what it takes to get through this? So is it in us?
Well, yes, I think so. I mean, the fact is of what you describe, which is rather humorous, that image that you give of the grocery store. I think you have to realize that I'm sure you do realize that the way in which we become acculturated, the way in which we become social beings, we do have, as Dacher infers in his book, an altruism there, but it has to be reinforced by the experience. And so when we speak of the generation that there was a few years ago, the greatest generation, those people grew up in the 30s, they knew about self control and about scarcity, and we will be breeding a new generation now, if we're sensible, who will also be able to understand what it means to think through complicated circumstances. The people who are in worst trouble, I think, are the people who are young, who have been taught that they are going to be extraordinarily privileged beyond their parents, and then the reality is that it's very difficult to achieve that from the material standpoint. So I think that, on the other hand, those young people are not foolish, and I see all around me a whole switch towards individuals who are in their teens and 20s. You see this, I think, in the last general election. You see people now beginning to say, you know, you guys in my age group screwed it up. It doesn't work the way you keep on telling us it works. We've got to think of a new way of doing it. So I think there's a whole energy out there that is yet to be focused and to channel, but I think it's coming, and I'm optimistic.
And Dacher Keltner, what are some of the qualities that parents should try to foster in their children to make them more prepared for what's ahead, to foster resilience?
Well, I think there are, first of all, I very much like Peter's observation, because, you know, teaching here at Berkeley, I see this new generation that is studious, and they're looking at our cultural conditions, and they're thinking about global warming and the fall of the stock market. And with this new election, they have a new view of how societies will conduct themselves. And I think Peter's right. There's a lot of reason for optimism. In terms of what parents should cultivate in children, it is one of the great determinants of the next generation. And I think we've learned a few very intuitive but powerful pieces of wisdom. One is, you know, there are studies of people who rescued the Jews during the Holocaust. These rescuers are hyper-altruists. And the thing that they uniformly reported is that their parents created a conversation at the dinner time table at when they put them to bed, the books they chose, that revolved around care and altruism. And we need to bring that discourse back into our family. The second thing we know is that parents are essential to creating the child's narrative about life, that narrative, the ability to reflect upon experience and stress, is one of the great antidotes to toxic stress. And we need to encourage that kind of reflection.
I want to bring in another caller at 1-888-477-9499. Let's get Alba to join us. Alba, hello, you're in Voices in the Family.
Hi, Miss Mike and two gentlemen. I hope that all three of you are well. I'll say what I wish to say and then I'll hang up. First of all, I want to say that both of you gentlemen are very cool, and especially you, Mr. Peter. What you are saying is hitting the nail on the head. Not all of us, if we're lucky, we can quote-unquote take care of ourselves if we happen to be physically not handicapped and have enough monetary funds to back that up. But that's not true for a lot of us, and that could happen to any one of us at any given time. So that's why, as you two gentlemen are saying, we do need a social network of all of us taking care of each other. God bless. Thank you, and I'll hang up now.
All right, thank you, Alba. I would have liked to ask you, Alba, what kind of social network you have, but maybe let's pose that question to both of you. How are people networking these days? Are they making connections? You know, how are they building a support system around them? Decker?
Well, I think one is the most obvious, but, you know, it's interesting. I was on a field trip last week with my daughter's third grade class, one of the dads was there, and his business was dramatically down, and he was happy. And he said, I get to be in my child's school again when I was instead, you know, 2 years ago flying all over the country. So clearly engagement with, you know, family-related activities is an important part. And I think that people are going to be rediscovering community through book groups and churches and all manner of institutions.
Peter, can you fake optimism for your kids? You know, I'm sure a lot of parents right now find themselves in a position where they really don't feel all that optimistic. I'm sure that dad was happy to be on the field trip, but there must have been somewhere inside the thought, oh my, how am I going to meet the bills next month? Or you know, what's going to happen to us?
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think that it isn't going to be easy. It's not, and people are losing their jobs. And, you know, I run a very big institute here at the University of California, and we're desperately trying to avoid the big pitfalls that are opening up here for the California budget and keep people on payroll and so on. So it's and we succeed, I think, 95-96% of the time, but some people do get hurt, and it's no doubt that this is going to be painful. But I do think, nonetheless, what Acker and I have been talking about is important, because the fallback is the engagement that the individual has with others and the collective care. It can happen in cities as well as in small towns. I happen to have part of my life exists on the East Coast, where I have an old farm that I bought years ago when I first came from England, and my daughters grew up there, and they live close by. And if you look at that small community, there are many, many people who are now pulling together, and it's perhaps easier to conceptualize in terms of an agrarian economy, because we literally are growing food and giving it to each other and helping each other during the winter months and the snowstorms and so on and so forth. But It can also happen in the cities. There are some wonderful things going on, even in big places like Los Angeles, where individuals have been trying to reclaim areas that once were essentially slums. And, you know, another big thing we're going to have to do is to think about suburbs and how we can create places for people who then can begin to walk back and forth from school, as opposed to driving their children all around Christendom in order to get to work themselves. I mean, there are all sorts of, once you begin to think like this, once you begin to think about social networks, it changes the whole way of thinking about town development, about on the west side here in Los Angeles, there's a whole group of business leaders who now are thinking about how can we make this a more of a community rather than having to go long distances to get what one needs in terms of not only of a work, but of school, of entertainment, etc. So I think it's shifting dramatically, and though very difficult on a short radio program to quantify it, but I think if you get into the web and you begin to look at community networks, you'll find an extraordinary amount of work is going on, which is very, very positive in my mind. So I don't think you have to gain false optimism. I think it's there. It just hasn't surfaced yet.
And Dacher, are you hopeful that the lessons we're learning now are here to stay? If you think about when the price for gasoline was so high, and it seemed like suddenly everybody was buying small car, and then gas was less expensive again, and it seemed that week the sales of SUVs went up. So sometimes it doesn't seem like we learn very well.
No, it takes a while to learn, but I am hopeful for a lot of the reasons that Peter is talking about. You know, an interesting analog is how we treat our fellow human beings. And Steve Pinker at Harvard University has done an excellent review that may surprise some of your listeners, which is that we are actually, contrary to what a lot of media suggest, becoming a more cooperative, less violent world. Murder rates are down in all European countries compared to 400 years ago. The death rate in wars is dramatically down. Forms of torture are much less prevalent. We treat the people in need much better than we did 300 or 400 years ago. And I see this moment as an opportunity for that kind of cultural growth, which is a lot of people are saying that buying more stuff is not only not a path to happiness, as we've been talking about, but not financially feasible. And it opens up the opportunity for these new communities and networks that are the great source of our best joys.
Let's see if we can fit in a quick phone call from Jane. Jane, hi, you're on Voices in the Family.
Hi. I have a question kind of in a comment. How do you kind of, with what you're talking, get the young people to understand that it is cyclical, that it's kind of, it's ebbs and flows. The life ebbs and flows. It goes up, it goes down. And I'm in my 50s. I lived through 70s, recession, depression, 80s, 90s, and it's here again. And it's here, and it's tough time, but it's going to get better. And American people are really good at doing their best where they're against the wall.
Okay, Jane, that's a good point. So, you know, sometimes we sit here and we say, wow, this is the worst it's ever been. But it really isn't the worst it's ever been, by no means. So how do we remind ourselves, okay, we've done this, we can do it again? Peter?
Well, I guess that's there in the history, as you just said. But this is a much greater downturn than one that we've had in least since the 30s. And I think that it does signal some important changes. It's not just the personal circumstance. It's also the fact that whatever argument one has, we're going to have to shift from fossil fuels to other means of energy. And we consume enormous amounts of energy now all over the world. We're going to have to think through, therefore, the way in which we travel from place to place. There are all sorts, there's a cascade of things that we are going to be challenged by. And actually, if you think of the human being as a resourceful animal, which we are, then this is a challenging time, which I think will go beyond the individual. The caller is absolutely right. Things will get better in terms of the economy, but I think this is an opportunity to think through what sort of economy do we need. Do we want one based entirely upon growth, expanding growth of the so-called GNP, or shall we recalculate that and ask ourselves exactly what is the GNP? You know, every time we put somebody in prison now, it adds to the GNP. That doesn't seem to me to be a very useful way of thinking about growth. Prison growth is not exactly what we're after here. So I think that we have an opportunity to rethink things just because people are anxious, they are worried, they are introspective now. We've stopped looking outward, we start looking inward, and that's a very positive sign.
And Dacher, to finish things up here, what's the importance of looking for positive things in your life? Because every time we turn on the news, this hour may be an exception, but usually it's all about the bad things. We've talked a lot about the positive, what can come out of this. So where do you find that in your everyday life when everything seems so gloomy right now?
Well, where I find that is that I think that very often in times of stress, and this is a deep moment of cultural stress, we go back to what's essential and true about who we are. And what I try to make a case for in the book is that what is essential and true is that we evolve to take care of others. We evolve to play. We evolve to fold into social connections. And those are what last in history. And I would also say alongside that what really gives me hope and optimism is the remarkable resilience of our young people. And they are already, as Peter's anticipating, envisioning our next culture, one based less on fossil fuels, one with different food practices, one that drives less and bicycles more, and that has healthier communities. So there are a lot of reasons to be optimistic.
And with that, we're going to have to close. I want to thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you, Micah.
My guests today have been Dacher Keltner and Peter Weibrow. Weibrow is the director of the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior at UCLA and author of American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. Dacher Keltner is a professor of psychology at Berkeley and author of Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. Earlier on, we were joined by Richard Broussel, a marriage and family counselor in Delaware. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll be talking about runaways. If you have a question, show idea, or comment, please email us at voices@whyy.org. You can listen to archive editions of Voices in the Family on our website, whyy.org/voices, and you can reach Dan directly at drdangottlieb@aol.com. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of radio content at WHYY. Our intern is Jonathan Glick. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons and Alisa Walters. I'm Mike and Scott, behavioral health reporter for WHYY, sitting in for Dan Gottlieb, and Dan will be back next week. Thank you for listening.
WHYY's behavioral health reporting is sponsored by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, a Quaker-based philanthropic organization committed to transforming how mental health is viewed and advancing innovative approaches to care. More at scattergoodfoundation.org.